Welcome back to another episode of the From Illumination to Innovation podcast. I'm your co-host, Shaniqua Brown, the founder and president of Elevated TA, the government premier hiring partner. And we are continuing with our second episode of our three-part brand series, Brand Shadow Series.
Thank you, Shaniqua. I am Stephanie Crane. I am the corporate mystic and owner of Tapas Innovation, and I am the author of the recently published book, Brand Shadow, Understanding and Overcoming Corporate Toxicity. And in our previous episode, we talked a little bit around individual shadows and sort of what that looked like and how we are bringing our own shadows into the workplace. And today I am really excited because we have a fantastic guest joining us to help us explore the concept of the organizational shadow in more depth. And so our guest is Leah Stiegler. And I have to read everything. It's like, even though she gave, I just want to say, the best, shortest bio ever. I love it. Okay. She says, a lawyer who works with HR and management to navigate the difficulties in life that happen at work. And so, Leah, thank you so much for joining us. And if you just want to tell us maybe a little bit more about, elaborate on your bio a little bit and what that means.
Sure. Well, thank you guys for having me. I'm a management side employment lawyer, so sort of call myself an HR lawyer. My day-to-day looks like being on the phone with human resources or in smaller companies, maybe CEOs or CFOs, and helping them navigate different employment situations, whether it's harassment, discrimination. Sometimes it's not even a legal issue, right? And I say, you know, sometimes my answer isn't legal. And I don't mean that like my answer is an illegal answer.
Right.
My answer is more business oriented, or we're talking about something sort of culture oriented before you even get to something that could be a legally actionable environment or some sort of lawsuit. So really just navigating issues with employers, do a lot of workforce trainings with my team. So oftentimes out, with the boots on the ground and the workforces. So I love it. It's great. And life happens at work. So thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And wow, that honestly, it sounds like you probably deal with a lot of interesting things, maybe some mundane things, but probably some interesting things that will come up for you in different organizations. And, you know, I'm curious, as we're here to talk about organizational shadows in particular, and I just want to like maybe preface a little bit just for my own, for the audience. In the previous episode, we talked about the individual shadow, and shadow just simply means unseen. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about organizational shadows, versus an individual shadow. An individual unseen shadow is also usually unconscious. They're not something they're usually aware of. That might be true for organizations as well, but sometimes with organizations, that unseen means hidden. And so I think shadows can come up organizationally in different ways. Sometimes I think companies maybe back into them a little bit. And then sometimes shadows, I think, are a little intentional. And so I just wanted to put that preface out there and ask you, from your perspective, I know you said that you read my book, and just your own experience, how do you see organizational shadows showing up?
Yeah, sure. In a couple different ways. And just my understanding sort of from reading the book is that there's sort of the shadows are sort of the things that a corporation, maybe the sort of forward thinking things, whether it's sort of their values or their branding, marketing techniques. And then when you kind of the real idea is get behind that, lift that up, and then look at the actual culture and what's going on. And Am I right about that?
Absolutely. Because one way I talk about addressing organizational shadows is through value alignment for organizations and brands to really not just be able to define their values, mm-hmm. but also to take action on those values. And when they're usually a shadow happens when there's a strong misalignment of what the organization is expressing as a value versus what the actual experience is for the employee or the customer. And so, again, it starts to show up as a shadow. and maybe the organization might use HR to try to mitigate that shadow. Or I say sometimes, you know, businesses might try to market their way out of a shadow, like they rebrand because they, you know, BP is one of my favorite like rebranding examples of like, well, let's just get a new logo and call ourselves something different. And eventually they'll forget what we did. And so those are, you know, kind of ways that I see organizations using departments within businesses to sort of mitigate shadows. But ultimately, I think shadows are driven by leadership and the culture of the company.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Especially from the employment side of things, I'll often see, you know, a company will have a value, they'll act like they are a very person-centric. You know, we focus on our employees and the employees are really the focus. And my take is you really need that in a sense. You need to make sure that the people aspect of a company is healthy, because you'll never get to that to profit if you don't have good people and good product, right? You've got to have, that's part of the equation. And so I'll see a situation where, you know, companies may not, the leadership may not value HR in a way that is allowing HR to be people-centric, or even management to be people-centric, where, you know, focusing on ensuring that the culture is okay versus really just results-driven management or results-driven HR, or using HR like a secretary almost. Hey, just process this new hire and this termination paperwork. Not really looking at the employee relations side of the business.
Hmm. Right. I'm curious, in those types of situations, how often are you coming in and mitigating something versus trying to maybe prevent?
Yeah, well, my general practice is hopefully to keep companies out of litigation, because litigation is extremely expensive. And so you want to try to do that upfront compliance. But I don't think, a lot of companies don't necessarily focus on it, or they may not see that they may be disillusioned as well as to their own way the company is operating, right? Mm-hmm. They may not self-assess in some way. And sometimes I'll see when a company faces a lawsuit, I'll give you guys an example, have a manufacturing client that has recently faced a lawsuit. And I think they were very shocked. They were shocked by it. They felt like, oh my goodness, you know, we are this incredible corporation. We even have lunch on site for our employees. Like, how could someone sue us, right? We even give attendance bonuses. And, you know, I'm looking at the facts of the situation. And in one sense, you had this, you know, powerful floor manager who just sort of terminates someone right on the spot, a long-term loyal employee right in front of everybody, all the other employees. And this employee had been there working overtime and, you know, deep diving on issues and sort of really being a great team player, maybe engaged in one mistake, one aspect of misconduct that was pretty serious, but to be kind of put on a platform. And Stephanie, you talk about in your book, sort of big traumas and micro traumas. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, watching a beloved colleague get terminated in front of everybody, yes. when that person is there working every weekend, that to me seems like a big trauma, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And then this, and the terminating person is sort of that, I can't remember the term you used, but in my head, it was BAP or big, the big ass producer, maybe.
The big ass producer. Yes, I did use that.
Yeah. If we're not.
No, you're fine.
You're perfect. We'll just
okay. I'll just say the BAP, right? You had this results-driven manager on the manufacturing floor, and the person was put there because they do produce product, right? They get the numbers going. They get, you know, but I will say when they're faced with this lawsuit from a pretty serious termination decision that was just kind of made off the cuff on the manufacturing floor, when the client gets the bill for my fees for dealing with a lawsuit, mm-hmm, then sure. the question is, how do you define that this person really is a big ass producer? Mm-hmm. Because if it's just to get product out the door, that's one thing. But if it's to ensure the company is getting product out and they're profitable, but in this case, if you were to attribute my legal fees or our firm's legal fees to this manager's decision, mm-hmm. I don't think that person would be profitable. And so I think defining really what is a producer as well, and kind of, you know, ensuring that companies take a self-assess their situation is really important.
Leah, what you're saying speaks to my heart. My business is in the employment side, where we actually focus on hiring. And a lot of my conversations with my hiring clients is around how can ensuring that we're hiring in a lawful manner, ensuring that our questions are lawful questions, ensuring that our hiring decisions are objective and we have data to stand on. When we're doing simple things like entering interview feedback, that is compliant and not opinion-based, because litigations are very costly. So in my research, looking at your background, I noticed on your LinkedIn, you mentioned the three Ps. I believe it was people, process, and product as essential to for business success. So I'm curious if you could explain how ignoring these people issues lead to organizational shadows that negatively impact company success.
Oh, absolutely. And I wish I could tell you I coined the term of the three Ps. And unfortunately, I can't even give credit to where I heard that from. But it really resonated with me as an employment lawyer, because you need to make sure that the people aspect of the workplace is healthy, because I will say lawsuits are not always filed based on fact, or maybe there is no such thing as fact. We could debate it all day long, right? Mm-hmm. Every fact is really just everyone's perception of the situation.
I like to think of fact as perspective. There's truth, mm-hmm. but fact is perception.
Right. And so lawsuits are filed based on someone's perspective of feeling wronged or feeling mm-hmm. unheard or feeling unseen. And, you know, I often tell clients, you know, you don't have to have a termination to even face a lawsuit. And in your sense, Shaniqua, you're dealing with recruiting. Oftentimes people don't even know that they have protections when they're applying for a job. They don't realize that anti-discrimination laws apply to them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in one sense, you've got this situation where, you know, companies, especially if you're a startup and you're growing, you really may be so focused on the product and looking to get to a stable point where you've got stable profit and all that. But if you don't really look at the people aspect from the entire life cycle, from recruiting and what happens in recruiting to the onboarding process, making sure people feel welcomed and have a mentor and understand they know who to report to if they feel uncomfortable or harassed at work, all the way through termination. Like, you want a healthy departure, you know, mm-hmm. offer a severance, make sure you can sleep at night and not sit there thinking, not sleeping for the next, 2 years, wondering if someone's going to file a lawsuit in the statute of limitations time period. So,
you know, I don't specifically talk about it in my book, but termination shadows. And I maybe mentioned, I wish organizations would celebrate departures, mm-hmm. you know, and really, you know, I know that there are times when, obviously, with hiring, and especially from both of you, I'm curious, you know, a lot of organizations are really making poor strategic hiring decisions that lead to massive layoffs, that lead to rehiring, that lead to, and this just incongruence of continuity and stability for society as a whole, you know. And it's like, how can organizations be more accountable to, you know, I mean, we've seen just even recently, the whole slew of, you know, letters that come across, you know, it's like my first day of work and I just got my termination letter, you know, and things like that, you know, and that's pretty to me, that's really shirking your responsibilities as a company to do that to an individual.
I mean, I feel in my opinion, at least, I feel that companies view employees as expendable, and an expendable resource versus the most important aspect of their business. And I think it makes it a lot easier to lay people off versus looking at creative ways that we can save money. I'm curious, Leah, what do you see on your side as being an attorney?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've never used as a defense, oh, well, we just recruited a bad employee. Like that's it's never come up. And I think, you know, oftentimes companies that may not sort of, whether they're disillusioned as to the toxicity in the company, or they're just not prioritizing their resources on the people that are actually working there, will often they'll be too quick to terminate, right? They won't do your progressive discipline. They won't do training. They won't actually give someone a chance to be successful. You know, they constantly want to go back to let somebody go that like, hire somebody 3 months later. Oh, they're not a stellar performer. Let me let them go. Go back to HR and say, hey, can you bring me more people? I need more people to fill this spot. And then that leaves HR to spend all this time recruiting versus actually management training and retaining talent. And in a lawsuit, if you terminate someone that quickly and they're blindsided by it, right? They've never been written up, never given a chance to succeed. Oftentimes they're going to go find a plaintiff's lawyer, or they're going to go file some sort of charge of discrimination or whatnot, because they're going to feel unheard and wrong and wronged and unseen. And I'm never going to sit there and talk to a client and say, well, maybe you just recruited the wrong person. You know, no, you didn't do the right thing during the life cycle of the employee, when the employee was actually in the workforce.
Mm-hmm. Well, you brought up a great point, Leah, about the training. And in my line of work, a lot of my clients want the new hire to just hit the ground running. Stephanie, I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. Mm-hmm. They want someone with the experience that is impossible because they don't work there. You must be able to hit the ground running. Don't require much like hand-holding at all. We just need you to produce. But I remember my first job out of college, there was a full training and development program where I started in the onboarding process. You know, like everyone, you get onboarded. Then the first day I'm in a like 3-week training. And then after the 3 weeks training, I'm on the floor doing my job. But like, I guess I'm calling out, like, whatever happened to this training? Like, do companies not see that training, like, after you onboard? I think companies just focus on onboarding. And then after that, it's like, good luck, sailor. Like, what happened to the actual training and development of employees before they're entering their actual role?
I would say profit center versus not profit center. Mm. And not tying the actions of an actual employee directly to the profit of the organization, because every single employee in the organization is supporting the purpose, vision, and profit of that company, regardless of how they're doing work and whether or not they're, you know, actively signing sales contracts, or they're, you know, doing back office work that's critically important to the operational survival of the business. And training falls into it's anything that's hard to measure the direct impact of. It's just a lot easier to throw people out there. And one of my questions for Leah is, like, when you work with somebody, do you notice any patterns around companies that tend to have more trouble with sort of shadows, you know, than in terms of like that seem to run into these issues over and over again? Like, are there any particular industries or any type of a company that seems to be more challenged by this, or any pattern that you could identify?
I would say, well, I tend to see a lot of it in manufacturing, and I can't say whether, you know, what I mean, I could probably speculate, perhaps it's because in manufacturing, you come into it thinking, oh, it's just, your job is just to make widgets. And so how you're doing the same thing every day, making these widgets. So if you're not making 10 widgets a day, then you're just not performing and you're out the door, right? I think that's a little easier of a scenario. And the hardest part, you know, for a lot of companies is when they have difficulties defining what's a good performer. It's because I oftentimes think performance can be subjective. And clients will sometimes come to me and say, hey, we want to let this person go. This employee's really not performing. And I'll say, well, have you ever tried putting them on a performance improvement plan of some sort? Mm-hmm. And it may not be that this person is making widgets and you can really quantify how they're performing, but whether the way they're performing is very subjective. And everyone has their own unique style too. And so if it's a position, whether it's like a marketing director or, you know, some sort of designer or something. You can, even a lawyer, right? Lawyers in my office, we all do things different ways. And so, you know, some of us are maybe more creative innovators, big picture thinkers, and other ones are a little more technical. They like to get into the weeds on things. Doesn't necessarily mean that one of us is a better performer than the other. So a lot of times it is subjective. And I think to your question earlier, Shaniqua, you know, it's sometimes I think companies have a hard time taking time to say, how do we train people where their assets can be of beneficial use to the company based on their qualities? And how can we use this person or repurpose them if maybe they're not fitting in this function and bring them over here?
How much, I'm curious, do you see neurodivergent challenges come up in situations like this?
That's a great question.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I guess sometimes it's hard, right? Because even I'm talking sometimes to a client behind a wall, right? It might be, you guys would probably be better suited to answer that in the sense of you're a lot more on the grounds with the workers, right? Mm-hmm. With the employees, whereas oftentimes I will be talking to the problem. And I hope my clients don't, I want my clients to listen to this because I'll probably tell you to your face, you are the problem sometimes. But
and so all of my clients are the problem too. So it's okay. I love y'all. I love y'all.
I mean, yeah, I love you guys. That's why I have job security, because you're such a problem. But but I'll, you know, they'll be complaining about something, or they'll be, you know, kind of dealing with something. And I'm like, you know, I think they're the disconnected one. And I'm thinking about a simple example of talking to a CEO who's, you know, out there and was sort of made a social media post complaining about, you know, how she has multiple nannies and housekeepers and her, like, something, you know, so she was just hated when someone canceled on her, and it was just dramatic and hard to find a replacement and all this. And she's kind of venting in victim mentality out there on her social media post, but is totally disconnected from the fact that she has people making minimum wage in her company who are going to see that and say, right, wow, I wish I could afford a nanny. Right.
Yeah.
And so it's that conversation of, like, you know, whether, you know, and then I have to sit there and say, okay, sometimes I have to educate my own client about how do I make this a priority for you to see what you're doing, what you're saying as a leader could really be the problem or could have that impact on other employees.
Wow.
But I don't know. What's your guys' take on that? Because you could answer it better than I could.
That's, and you know, from my perspective, and I actually have worked with quite a few neurodivergent people, and I see that there's a lot of times there is a corporate norm. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty limited. And if you fit into that corporate norm, then, you know, you can sort of, I guess, more easily play that game. But that has been shifting so much over the last few years. And we've sort of really expanded our talent pool, and we've recognized the incredible value that all different types of people have to bring into our environments for whatever reason. You know, to your point about people thinking differently, like, you know, that difference of perspective can just be like, if everybody's thinking the same, you know, I mean, you're just sort of like, I think very like, not allowing yourself to expand and create possibilities. But when you bring in people who think differently, and somebody might just look at a process in a different way, and it could have such a huge profit impact, but it's being open to that. Mm-hmm. And it's being willing to sort of hear that and doing so, you know, without bias. And I think that that's another big challenge, you know, is that there's a lot of bias that gets brought into these environments, and especially, you know, like a cycle of, I compare it to dysfunctional families. I think, you know, we've created sort of a dysfunctional leadership cycle, and a lot of that just gets carried over. And so we have bad leaders training bad leaders, you know, we have, you know, like, and it just gets elevated in our organizations as a whole.
In my role hiring, we have since been focusing on inclusion. And I think it's been very difficult for my hiring managers. I have a lot of empathy for them because they may desire inclusion, but they're not equipped to create, like, to manage inclusion, meaning if we were to hire someone that's neurospicy, it would be very challenging on that manager who would need someone that in their mind, right, in their mind is easier to just have someone that's similar to them. So then they feel confident in delegating to them because they know what they would do versus like having someone that could like hiring new people into their organization that would be more holistic in different ways of thinking or viewing problems or even being having like different neuro capacities. So I think on the hiring side is a bit more challenging with the neuro divergence.
I only want to respond really quickly and say that this is where my core leadership coaching skills come in, because as you develop your own emotional intelligence and you learn to understand people better and to meet them where they're at, you become less triggered by their things that are different, you know, that you might make you feel uncomfortable or might make you feel awkward. That starts to dissipate more because you become more consciously aware of the actual energetic connections you're making with
people. I agree. And the point I was making is that the organizations move so quickly.
They don't take
that. It's difficult for the manager in the sense if the manager could not be triggered and take the time, but that would put that manager at a disadvantage because the organization is moving so fast.
You're right.
So to your point, I think if the leaders at the top could create an environment where we could slow down and make decisions, I think that would be helpful for us to add in more inclusion. But I do know that we have to take a quick break and then we'll transition to the second segment.
Yeah, so we will take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to look at some real world examples of corporate toxicity in action. So we'll see you in just a second. Shaniqua, why do we illuminate?
Stephanie, so we can innovate. But what are we illuminating?
Brand shadows.
Provocative perspectives.
Innovative ideas.
Courageous storytelling.
We are illuminating the way we think about business.
And in the process, innovating how we do business. Find us on YouTube and subscribe today.
And we are back for the second half of the second show of our Brand Shadow series. And we have our amazing guest, Leah Stiegler, with us. She is an employment attorney, and she is helping us examine organizational shadows. Mm-hmm. And during this segment, we're going to talk a little bit about some real-time shadows in the news. And things that are just, you know, kind of happening right now that a lot of us might be familiar with. I'll briefly, you know, in my book, I wrote about a couple of organizations.
Which ones did you write about?
I wrote about my favorite one to complain about is Boeing. I have a natural fear of flying anyway. I just want to say this, okay? So I'm not going to lie. Boeing has seriously pissed me off, okay? I talk about, and they continue, by the way, to show up in the news, okay? So it's not like I think it's going to be topical for maybe ever. Who knows? But definitely elevating the shadow aspect of them, you know, retaining the value of engineering excellence on their website, front and center on their website, and then clearly not living up to that.
That is rich.
It just drives me absolutely insane. And I know they're now being investigated by the DOJ, and I know that all of their key leaders have, you know, bailed and probably, and no puns intended here, with golden parachutes flying out of their planes. And so, you know, it's like,
well, that's just the door.
Yeah, well, it's true. I mean, but see, that's just the thing. The executives of Boeing, they knew to wear their golden parachutes on the plane. Okay. Nobody else was aware of that. Okay. And so it's just, you know, again, transparency matters, right? Transparency in business and living up to and actioning the values. And it's not just, you know, again, like they've done to the entire general public and, you know, the psychological unsafety they've created, but honestly, they've been atrocious to their employees, like just completely atrocious to them. And so there's so much there.
Yeah. And I, from the employment side, one trend that I'm seeing just across the nation for all companies are whistleblower claims. And most states, so you have federal whistleblower claims, but most states have enacted their own sort of anti-retaliation protections. And, you know, all an employee has to do is report in what they believe is in good faith, some sort of violation of state, federal, local law, or some sort of regulation, or, you know, even the engineering guidelines, right? Safe, that comes under safety. And if they're terminated for that, you know, they have a whistleblower claim. And so there are those whistleblower protections. And I think, you know, maybe Boeing just being sort of this huge giant didn't think, and maybe they were disillusioned to thinking that everybody that worked there was on board with what they were doing, and versus actually someone on the ground working on the plane saying, "Hey, this is really unsafe. Like, people could die. And blowing the whistle."
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because John Oliver actually did a report on Boeing. It was a few months ago that he did it, but one of the pieces of his report was an actual employee wearing an undercover camera and going around to other engineers actively working on planes on the floor and saying, "Would you fly on a Boeing?" And them saying, no, I wouldn't fly on this plane. And like, he's, wow. And so, I mean, the level of toxicity in that organ, and you bring up the size, which is a really big deal because, you know, it's the Titanic, right? It's going to hit the iceberg. Like, they're not going to, people ask me all the time when I'm talking about healing corporate culture, it's like, you know, well, what do you do about the really big companies? I'm like, pray. I mean, like, they're not going to change, you know, and really there's an opportunity to either, in my mind, prevent toxic culture, or up to a certain sized organization, you can go in and work with leadership and really make that shift. But when it gets too big, you know, that culture is so embedded and so complex and complicated that I think, you know, maybe departmentally you might be able to have an impact.
Well, I think that brings like a larger question that we could all, like, I don't have an answer, but I think it's more rhetorical. Like, how big is too big? You know, when we talk about organizations, as it pertains to capitalism, because capitalism is about that profit. So how big is too big? And Leah, I'm curious, could you share your thoughts on how leadership style and transparency, or the lack thereof, can cast shadows that impact an entire company's reputation?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think people expect transparency today. And I think that's probably different than, you know, 30, 40 years ago, where it was sort of the norm that people in a boardroom made decisions, and then that those decisions were directed out to the rest of the organization. And I think now, even in my own law firm, you know, people expect transparency. They want to know why decisions are made. They want to know if they're going to be affected by a top-down decision. They also want to feel heard and feel a part of that. I don't know if you guys are seeing that trend as well. And I think corporations they can no longer hide behind a closed door boardroom. They have to come out. They have to make public statements.
Well, what about the ones that are making public statements that are actively toxic?
Who do we think we're all talking about?
Yeah,
maybe the last
clearly doesn't have
Tusk.
Anyone in well, see that's one where the shadow is, I think that the shadow there is a shiny things shadow, right? It's yeah. Like so yes. Cool. I by the way, I saw a Tesla truck on the highway the other day.
Was it in one piece ever.
Ugliest thing I've ever seen in my life.
They're very not attractive.
Yeah. But it, like, between SpaceX and Tesla and, you know, these ideas to like drive cars underground, that sounds so cool and shiny. And I think there's this shadow of like, I want to be a part of that. I want to be a part of this innovation, this trend. But really that is so, it's so far fetched in a sense, and that they're ignoring, it's not really actually looking at the people that are working there, and what's actually happening to get from this little idea to this huge big picture actual infrastructure that we'd like to see, or that the company Musk wants to see out there.
Mm-hmm. So the town I live in, it was just reported yesterday, has been selected by Mr. Musk as his new headquarters. And so, you know, for me, I am surrounded by Tesla, one side, Boring Company on the other. And I, you know, we're becoming, you know, Muskland. And it's really interesting to see how, you know, he expresses leadership and how the people respond to that, you know, and there are certainly a lot of people that respond to it in negative ways and they don't appreciate what he's doing. But, you know, he definitely has, and to your point of like that shiny thing shadow, you know, he definitely has a base of people who just really deeply aspire to sort of the persona that he projects. And I see, like, when I look at so many of the you know, even what just happened with X recently with Brazil, where, you know, he typically does just sort of do what he wants to do. And he doesn't really care, I think, a lot of times what that impact is. You know, he doesn't really care what the impact on shareholders is, what the impact on his employees. You know, he's being very kind of driven by his own reactions, his own, you know, kind of emotional triggers. But it's interesting, like with Brazil, where they actually had to acquiesce and, you know, make a business change, you know, based on another country's laws. And so I just think it's interesting, like what we're willing to tolerate, you know, and looking at how other countries kind of deal with these same types of organizations. You know, I know in Europe, there's a lot less tolerance for sort of certain types of corporate malfeasance and things like that. So that to me feels sort of like a U.S. corporate shadow that we have.
Well, you know, that's interesting because in a lot of places in Europe, you know, there is no such thing as termination, or I mean, employment at will. So you really have to have cause for termination. And a lot of countries even require certain amounts of severance. And so absolutely. I think that forces companies to go through the, it's one thing to have a policy, a company could take Europe's laws and make those into a handbook, and that's your workplace policy. And we're going to have progressive discipline and performance improvement plans before we terminate, and everyone's going to be guaranteed a severance based on how long you've worked here or whatnot. And so maybe that's a way that a company could do it. But I do think there are those protections that legally that almost force companies to. In Europe to go through those processes that do allow employees more opportunities to be successful. Mm-hmm. And I think in a situation, I'm going to put a wager out there. I bet you both $100. Actually, I'll say $20 because I know I'm not really ready to bet that much. Okay. But the Musk facilities by you, Stephanie, in a few years, they're all going to be unionized. And I think that's
really
way, that's
curious
a way,
about that.
Yeah, we're seeing trends where more and more workforces are unionizing over the last 2 or 3 years. And a lot of that is, I think it's the employees kind of a grassroots effort to say, you know what, if our culture top down isn't going to be, if our top down culture or leadership isn't going to fix the culture from a top down standpoint, then we're going to band together and dictate what the culture is, at least in terms of safety and wages and benefits.
It'll be really interesting to see how your bet turns out, being that I would consider Texas to be one of the strongest at will states for termination. And he really picked Texas for a lot of reasons.
100%. And I think it's also highlights how little of our rights that employees, that we as employees understand. I'm no longer an employee, but I feel like it's really important to not only understand our rights as citizens, but then also understand our rights as employees, because it is in our best interest to ensure that we're one working with companies that are aligned with our mission and vision, our principles, and then also that at least at the bare minimum have our safety top of mind. I'm curious if there will be some unions in the future. I hope so. Or
I
at least
so
there will be.
Oh yeah. At least there will at least be a good substance, Stephanie, for your second book, the memoirs of the former Musks.
Oh my God. Thank you for that.
You'll be on the ground.
Making it a note right now.
Yeah. And, interview every former employee of their experience. That's
they're all around me. I can totally. Okay, call out, y'all. Get a hold of me.
After you call her, probably call a plaintiff's lawyer, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Call me, then call Leah, then call Shaniqua. That's rich. Leah, I'm curious. As companies grow, especially startups, what advice would you give leaders on how to proactively prevent these shadows from forming, particularly in terms of people management and culture?
That's a great question. And I think what I've noticed, because I work with industries of all sizes, right? It could be a huge hospital system or a small startup with one or two employees. And I've seen a lot of companies over the last 10 years that I've worked with, you know, go from being a one-person shop with an idea to now having 50 employees or 80 employees. And I as an employment lawyer have to take stock and say, you know, I can give you the law all day long and tell you this is how you legally pay someone to do this particular job. And these are the types of tasks that you can have them do them. And here's how you can have them do these tasks safely in accordance with OSHA. So I can set these parameters, right? But oftentimes as a startup, I think I've noticed a lot of startups, either one, they don't have stable funding to pay people according to our wage and hour laws, right? So they're trying to make them contractors and pay them easily and say, oh, here, I'll just pay you per task or something like that. Or not, I won't pay you at all. Maybe I just convince you that our mission and our
sweat
team
equity
is so incredible. Yeah, you'll put in your sweat equity and I'll promise you orally some ownership one day, and then things fall apart and that doesn't happen. They're facing legal liability, whether it's wage and hour laws or, you know, breaches of contract and stuff. And so I think I'll set that box, those parameters, and say, hey, here's, if you want to do things perfectly legal, here's how you can operate within them. But I know from a startup standpoint, they can't always fit exactly in that box if I confine them so much and get off the ground and get the investor funding they need. And so I think that's okay if you've got to take that risk, because really just, I mean, what I do all day is just analyze the risks. I could tell you, hey, that employee, it's unlawful to terminate that employee right now. You want to terminate her for reporting sexual harassment. Well, that's unlawful retaliation, but they can do whatever they want. They're just taking a bigger and bigger risk, right? And so all I do is tell people the risks. So if a smaller company has to take that risk to ultimately be successful and get to a position where they can later focus, at some point, I think they've got to sit down and say, okay, let's go back to making sure we are in compliance mm-hmm. with these things, because otherwise those things just continue out and just to fester and grow, and those problems become bigger and bigger and the legal liability can be substantial.
It's like building bad habits on top of bad habits, basically.
Right. Yeah. Or if you have a small company, right, where you have a couple of individuals who start it, and there's I have a client who went from starting a business in their dining room, and they started with two friends. They were all stay-at-home moms, and they kind of started this business part-time or whatever. And as they grow, and they were all very close, right, just walk into each other's houses, their doors, watch each other's kids, all that, super close, go on vacations together. And that culture, that intimate culture can be okay for a small setting. But as they grew and gained more employees and bought leased office space and brought more people into that, then that culture those types of boundaries or lack thereof don't really work for every person
Absolutely.
And every type of healthy workplace.
Yeah. Not only that, but in situations like that, it's like that small culture, they become adapted to each other, sort of, if they have some subtle toxic behaviors that are maybe not necessarily so toxic in that space. But when you add 50 more people, it amplifies it, so to speak, you know? And so it's, yeah, I think that's a real hard transition for businesses.
I think about Blizzard. You guys know Blizzard. I think it's called Blizzard Game, gaming company.
Absolutely.
And now they're a very, very large corporation, but they have a predominantly male workforce that, you know, a lot of gamer mentalities. Now I'm stereotyping, so don't cancel me because I'm doing it. It's my perception of the facts, right?
Yeah.
But they've been hit because of that sort of locker room kind of frat mm-hmm. boy culture that fits that stereotype, right? Unfortunately, because I think a lot of that is, you know, you've got people who oftentimes do work and at Blizzard, you know, you've got people working from home during the pandemic, developing video games. They're in a smaller community. They're maybe often used to sitting at home with a headset on and saying, you know, secretly, you know, behind a computer wall and gaming and saying really rude, crass things because they're in the safety of their own home where no one's going to come at them for anything. And then you put them in those people in a work environment, almost doing the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. And they had that same sort of crass video game discussion culture in the workplace, or at least that's what the allegations were. And they faced a huge class action.
You know, it's interesting because that particular industry, and I read several things about, I'm very interested in that industry as a whole from a cultural perspective and technology in general, but women, there is a real serious gender bias in that industry mm-hmm. that's very real. And even to the degree I was reading about a female gamer influencer that was, you know, receiving death threats and like literally had to go into hiding. And then another really, really interesting story was a male gamer who created a female persona just to go out and like just the amount of misogyny and hostility that was put upon him. And he was able to witness sort of, you know, this is the environment, this is the culture of this environment. And so, and that gets even really serious when you get into like the actual coders and the profession of it, you know, like not getting beyond the gamers and like getting into the actual people who are creating the games. And so it's interesting that you brought that up. I'm curious, we're coming to our wrap on this, and we like to do quick takeaways. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't mind, Leah, like what takeaways would you like to offer our audience? And also, how can our audience learn more about you or find you if they need you?
Sure. My main takeaway is while I potentially am a really fun friend, I'm not the cheapest friend, right? And so I think companies need to understand that, you know, maybe whether they've been doing something for so long the way they've always done it, I hate that phrase, by the way, oh, we've always done it this way, mm-hmm. right? Or they're just not willing to take stock of what their actual culture is, or they're not willing to be people-centric in any way. At some point, those are the companies that are going to face legal claims from an employment sense. And it may not just be one employee suing them. It could be an entire class action of employees. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, if you really care so much about profit, if you don't really care enough about people, there are actually legal claims that, you know, could result in hitting your bottom line so much that you no longer become profitable. So mm-hmm. focus on the people, that part of the piece, the three piece. And you can find me on LinkedIn, Leah Stiegler, my firm's website, Woods Rogers. And we have a great employment law team and we work all over the country. And then we have a little YouTube series called What's the T in L&E, which L&E stands for Labor and Employment. It's a little 2 to 4 minute series every 2 weeks on different hot topics. So
excellent. We'll make sure that we link to all of that in our program. So what about you, Shaniqua? What takeaway do you have for us?
Similar to Leah's, it's focusing on the people. The people are the heartbeat of the organization. And if you're too focused on profits, you're missing out on the opportunity to actually make more money, in my opinion. And I think it all starts with sharing the vision and the mission, getting people bought in. Because you're doing, as an entrepreneur, I feel like that's what we're doing on the ground floor to mm-hmm. get people, to get clients to share. And there's like some disconnect where the organization grows to, you know, hitting $100 million, you know, and all of a sudden there's lack
priority
of
shift.
Yeah, the priority shift to just profit. So I think really focusing on the people, focus on evangelizing the mission of the company will help you see more profits. I'm going to guess tenfold.
You know, the takeaway I want to leave with the audience is that brand shadow absolutely is about all of us. Mm-hmm. And whether you're an individual and you're bringing your shadow to work, or you need to find a way to empower yourself in your own professional environment, or I want to share this stat at the end because I found this doing some research before this show. A recent study, 52% of CEOs say their workplace culture sucks. Oh. Y'all, CEOs.
Wow.
That's unacceptable. So leaders, you have a lot of work to do. And I really, you know, we all need to be taking honest looks at ourselves, how we show up as leaders, how we show up as people in our organizations. And we all can contribute to solving this problem. Mm-hmm. So
thank you so much, Leah, for joining us. It's been a pleasure getting to know you. And to our audience, please be sure to get your copy of Stephanie's book, Brand Shadow.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you,
guys. Thanks, Leah.
Thanks for listening to our show. Show us your support by following us on your favorite podcast platform, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
You can also find us on Castus at fromelimination2innovation.castus.com. If you love our show, share it with your friends and coworkers too. Let's all work together to help businesses vibrate higher.